Good morning. So last time we introduced this idea of pipelining. So we said, well, we have a bunch of components in our big single cycle processor design we use in, and a lot of the time they probably aren't doing work. Like we think of the instruction memory, it fetches the instruction, and only after it does that can our register file usefully read a value, can our ALU usefully add values together. And that means that for most of the cycle, the instruction memory is just not really doing anything. And couldn't we have it instead start with the next instruction? And similarly, the register file, like it reads the instructions values from the, and then the read part of the register file is not really doing anything. Couldn't we have it do something else during that time, like execute that part of another instruction? And we had this sort of assembly line style where we divide our instruction into stages. We do the work for the first stage for one instruction, then that instruction moves to the next stage while the next instruction does the first stage, and so on. So we have this sort of assembly line style where instructions go from one stage to the next, and the instruction after them in the program follows behind. And we should get a lot more efficiency because we're, you know, not having our components not doing anything most of the time. And we talked about sort of measuring how much this actually helped. And we had sort of this notion of latency with the time from when we started to when we finished versus throughput, which is the rate at which we finish. And we learned that, well, it turns out that doing this pipelining thing probably increases our latency. It increases the time from when an instruction starts to when an instruction finishes, but it's dramatically faster for what we actually care about, which is how often we finish instructions. We're going to be finishing more instructions per unit time, even though each of the instructions will take longer because we're doing multiple at a time. We're doing pieces of multiple at a time. And we sort of gave an analogy for thinking about this improvement with laundry, that, you know, if I do my laundry where I go washer to dryer or fold right away, you know, with one load at a time, that's going to be the fastest way to do each load. But that's not the fastest way to do a bunch of loads of laundry, because I have time where I'm not using the washer and the dryer where I could be. Now, for circuits, we had to do a little extra work on the circuit to make it so we could implement this pipelining idea. And this was because, well, when I said that those components weren't doing anything during most of the time during the cycle, that wasn't entirely true. That our instruction memory, yes, after we read the instruction, it's not doing, you know, anything complicated, but it's holding the value of that instruction to send to all the other components in the circuit. And those other components need that value to work. And if we start fetching a different instruction, well, it's not holding that value anymore and they're gonna break. So we need some fix for that, and our fix was that we'd add pipeline registers to store the value that we just computed in that prior stage for the next stage, so we could move on to another operation without disrupting the next stage. And sort of our basic pattern is that we'd add pipeline registers between each pair of stages, and we'd also rearrange our signals so values go from one stage to the next, never sort of skipping around. Now, mention that pipelining sort of improves performance, and we said, oh, well, we can just divide up circuits into pieces to add pipelining. And we asked, well, how much can that help us? You know, how far will that get us? And we saw there were two sources of diminishing returns, two reasons why we would not have this help us infinitely or even close to infinitely. So one of them is that when we're doing this pipelining idea, dividing things up into stages, our resulting circuit is only going to be as fast as the slowest stage. And in practice, we're not going to be able to say divide up and add into equal pieces, even if we can even divide it up. We're going to have sort of uneven sizes of division just because it's not going to be practical to find places to divide things up which exactly divides up the work evenly in time. Another issue we had is that, well, we need to add registers to store values, and, well, we've kind of so far looked at registers as kind of free, but registers are not instantaneous. No, so we said, our model before was we have this rising edge of a clock. That's when the register copies its input to its output. That's kind of an instantaneous thing, but physically that's not actually possible. The register can't be instantaneous. It needs a little time before and after that rising edge where the signal is stable or changing, stable before and where its output will be changing. And we need to account for that time, and that's going to limit the returns and performance we can get by adding pipeline stages, because we're going to be adding this extra register time, and we're going to have to pay for that. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so we had our pipeline add processor last time, which we had these stages with pipeline registers in between them. And we said, you know, a way we could look at its execution was this sort of chart of register values over time. So I'm showing the output of the register. So initially, we're fetching, our fetch stage is getting that the PC is zero, which is for this first instruction. Then the instruction in cycle one moves on to the decode stage. So our decode stage is getting that it should read registers 8 and 9. And while that's happening, the fetch stage is getting the PC of 2 to fetch the next instruction. And similarly, during the cycle 2, our execute stage gets the values 800 and 900 from the decode stage, along with register 9, which will eventually be passed to the write-back stage, while the decode stage is working on reading registers 10 and 11, and while the fetch stage is working on reading the instruction with PC4. And we can see that all these instructions go through basically each step, one after another, one following behind the other. Some questions on this diagram from last time? Okay, so we have this diagram. Let's ignore these timings, we'll talk about later, but have this exercise here. So let's say we're running these three instructions here. And let's say instruction one here just stored the result in RBX. What is instruction three? What did instruction three just do? As a hint, one way you could figure this out systematically is we could complete this chart of during each cycle what's happening in each of our stages. One way to figure this out. Okay, who would like some more time? Let's see. So let's see. So who thinks? A, B, C, D, and E. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus on B. So, yeah. So I guess one way of figuring this out would be to fill out this chart like so. So initially during cycle 1, 0, instruction 1 is in fetch, then it's going to be in decode, and instruction 2 is going to be in fetched. Then it's going to, instruction 1 is going to advance to execute, instruction 2 is going to advance from fetch to decode, and instruction 3 is going to be, should just erase and be more careful. 3 is going to advance to fetch, and then instruction 1 is going to do write back, instruction 2 is going to do execute, instruction 3 is going to do decode, and the end of write back is when it writes the result in RBX, which means the end of decode is when instruction 3 is going to do what instruction 3 is going to be doing at the same time. Another way I could have sort of figured this out, maybe a little less work, is I could say, oh, it just wrote back, so it's over here in write back, and behind it is instruction 2 in execute, and behind that is instruction 3 in decode. So questions, how I figured that out? All comfortable with this? Okay, so we know about sort of our mechanical operation. Let's talk about figuring out how fast things can be. So last time we talked a bunch about throughput and latency, and we dealt with kind of simple scenarios where we had like our add 3 circuit, where it was pretty obvious where our bottlenecks would be. But we're going to talk about that a little more formally. So when we have lots of options for what needs to happen in a cycle, we need to consider sort of all the ways from getting from something which happens at the beginning of the cycle to something which happens at the end. And I rate state output to state input because the things which happen at the beginning of a cycle are registers change. Things which happen at the end of a cycle are restore values. And we need to consider every possible way of a value getting from a register changing to someplace where we're going to store it at the end of a clock cycle, and that needs to have enough time for the clock cycle to happen. So we need to set our clock cycle to the largest time of any of these paths. And we call that largest time, that path with the largest time, the critical path. And it's what determines our cycle time. Note that we have to choose one clock cycle time. So yes, it might be possible to make a processor which like varies what the clock cycle time is based on what instructions are running, but this is generally not done. It's probably too complicated to do, practically speaking, even though it's probably, there's probably ways of doing that sort of thing, but it's not very practical. So generally, we're going to set a cycle time that doesn't depend on what instructions are running at the moment. So for example, we have a data memory that isn't always used. And you might say, so can't we make the clock cycle shorter if we're not using the data memory? And the answer is generally going to be no. We're going to choose a cycle time that's not going to vary depending on exactly what instructions we're running right now. And so the way we'd figure out what our cycle time is, we'd look at our processor and we'd say, what are our possible paths from something which happens at the beginning of a cycle, generally a register changing, to something that happens at the end, generally storing a value. So we have like reading a value from the PC and putting it through the adder. We have reading a value from the PC, putting it through the instruction memory, and putting it through that the PC increment adder. And let's say this first one takes 25 picoseconds, the second takes 50 picoseconds. We know at this point we need at least 50 picoseconds for a cycle time. And we keep doing this. We find, oh, we also need to be able to get a value through the instruction memory, through the register file, through the ALU, and to the register file to do a write. And let's say that takes 400 picoseconds. Now we know we need at least 400 picoseconds for our clock cycle. And we keep doing this. So we find out, oh, but we also need to be able to get a memory through the ALU and through the data memory and to the register file. So let's say that takes 900 picoseconds. Well, that's our new cycle time now. It's the longest one we have so far. We just keep doing this analysis until we go through all the paths. When we take the slowest one, that's going to determine our cycle time. Some questions? That looks like. And so we can do this for, say, our simpler processor here. And here I can actually like enumerate all four of the paths. And we say, OK, the longest ones are 500 picoseconds. So that's going to be our cycle time. Where presumably we'd have been told, you know, how to measure how much time things take. Now, this is with a single cycle design. Let's talk about doing this with pipelining. With pipelining, we're going to apply the same principle. And we're going to look at all the paths and all the stages. And whichever one's longest, so our slowest stage with the slowest thing through it, even if there's multiple ways, it's going to determine our cycle time. So we'll say, OK, we have to do this add to operation. And we have to go through the instruction memory to the next registers. And these are both things that have to happen in one cycle. Also in one cycle, we need to go from the output of the fetch to decode registers through the register file to the input of the execute to write back, so decode to execute registers. So that's another thing which needs to happen in a cycle. Also, we need to be able to take a value from the decode to execute registers and go through to the execute to write back registers. So we just write down all these paths, we time how long they are, how much time they need, and we take the longest time. And in this case, we're saying that with these timings, it's the instruction memory that's the slowest thing. So it determines our cycle time because that's the slowest path. Note that even though we had a different path in fetch here through the add to, it didn't contribute to the cycle time. And why not? Well, because this instruction memory path is slower. And it happens in parallel. We don't have to go through, we don't have to add to and then go through the instruction memory. That's not how it works. We just have to either go through the instruction memory during a cycle or go through the add to. We'll do both at the same time, but we're doing them at the same time. We don't have to do one then the other. So that's why only one determines our cycle time. And in this case, the instruction memory access is slowest, so it's what determines the cycle time. If our add two for some reason was super slow, maybe it would make our cycle time slower. So questions on figuring out the cycle time by looking at paths like this? Yes?
So are you saying for that, like for the same instruction, they could happen at the same time?
Question, am I saying for one instruction, these would have that the adding two and the accessing the instruction memory would happen in parallel? Yes, with this design, that is what would happen. Because remember, are things that aren't triggered by the clock cycle, once they have their inputs, they'll start working. And both the add to and the instruction memory get all their inputs, in this case, at the same time. So they should start working at the same time, and they'll probably take different amounts of time to finish. Does that answer your question? Other questions? OK, so that's. So sort of a written version of this. So here we have our processor, and I've just written down the speed of each component. And we'd say without pipelining, it turns out that we need to be able to do all these. Why all these? Because our slowest path goes from the PC output. We need to go through everything in the single cycle processor. Our slowest path looks like that when the pipeline registers aren't there. And that's how we get everything but add two. The add two is not on the slowest path because, you know, the add two happens in parallel with the slowest thing, which is going through the instruction memory and then the register file, and then the adder, and then back into the register file. With the pipelining design, the paths we need to consider are what we showed before, and the slowest one was the one with these timings through the instruction memory. So with this chart of timings here, it's 200 picoseconds plus we have the pipeline register delays. And I'm not being very precise about accounting for the pipeline register delays in either case, but know, we know we have pipeline register relays somehow added up to, added into these. So questions on how I got these timings here? Okay, so let's say I make a change. So we have our pipeline processor, which we learned the 200 picoseconds per cycle, because our critical path was we went from the program counter through the instruction memory to the fetch to the code registers. And that was the slowest thing. That took 200 picoseconds plus whatever the register delays were for the PC and the fetch to the code registers together. So the last half of the register delay for the PC and the first half of the register delay for the fetch to the code registers, which is basically one register delay. So that was our 200 picoseconds cycle time that we had before. My question is, let's say I modify this by combining the add and the register file together. So I get rid of these pipeline registers. Instead of having four stages in our pipeline, we have three. And my question is, after I do that, what's our new cycle time? Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? B? Okay, C? D? E? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus for E, is what I get. So why do we get that? So if we want to look at this, we know that we just made a change between our execute and decode stages, so I shouldn't need to consider anything else in the processor because those paths have not changed how long they need. So my question is just, have the paths through the decode and execute stages changed? So if I look at what I had before, previously I had my two register read paths, and these both are take the same amount of time. They took 125 picoseconds, excluding register delays, and now I'm adding on to them a 100 picosecond path. So our new path is 225 picoseconds. And the question we have to ask is that now going to determine our cycle time? And the answer in this case is yes, because it's larger than the previous critical path. So we have a new critical path. This is now the slowest thing. It's 225 picoseconds plus the register delay, because we need to have the output of the fetch to decode register stabilize at the beginning of the cycle, and we need to have enough time for the execute, for the now decode plus execute to write back register to read its input at the end of the cycle. Questions? This all comfortable. Okay. So talked about sort of timing for pipeline circuits and adding registers. Let's talk a bit about implementing it in HCI. So first, some naming convention things. So the convention our textbook uses for naming the inputs and outputs to pipeline registers is that we're going to declare our fetch to decode registers as lowercase f, capital D, and that means the inputs are going to be named with a lowercase f after the fetch stage that they come from, and the outputs are going to be named with an uppercase D after the decode stage that they go to. And similarly, our decode to execute registers are going to be named with lowercase d, capital E, meaning the inputs from the decode stage are named with a lowercase d, and the outputs to the execute stage are named with an uppercase E. A consequence of this is that if we're looking at, say, writing the code for the decode stage, all the values we're getting using with pipeline registers, all the inputs come from lowercase, the name of the stage, all the outputs go to uppercase, the name of the stage. So we have lowercase d values as our inputs for writing the code, uppercase d is where we're writing our outputs for the next stage to use. And the same is true for the other stages. For the execute stage, we're going to read values from uppercase e signals and write them to lowercase e signals. Questions about this naming convention? So this is, as I said, is a naming convention. This is how our textbook names things. This is how I'd recommend naming things when you're writing HCL code. But obviously, it's not enforced because you can put whatever name letters you want when you declare a set of registers. But it has the advantage that if you follow this convention, sort of the code for each stage will be dealing all with values which start with the letter of that stage or values for the components that are part of that stage. So for example, the decode stage will be dealing with the lowercase d signals that it's sending values to the next stage with, the uppercase d signals it's receiving the values from fetch with, and also the register file signals that it uses for register reads. So if we follow this convention, if we're thinking about implementing the add processor in HCL, how are we going to end up writing these registers? Well, you mentioned that our fetch to decode registers will be declared with lowercase f, capital D. And based on the diagram, we need registers to store two register indices, or we'll say RA and RB. So I've declared 4-bit registers for RA and RB. Why 4 bits? Because that's the size of register indices in our instructions. I've set them equal to the constant regnum, which is just another name for OXF, but very much more readable to write it as regnum, so I know what it means. And in the fetch stage, I set the input to these registers based on the instruction memory to the parts of the instruction that represent those register indices. And in the decode stage, I can use them. So for example, I use the value of RA to set reg source A to actually read the register. And I use the value of RB to pass through to the next stage as the def D value that's eventually going to end up in write back. Also, in the decode stage, since I'm reading registers, I need to take the register file output and send it to the next stage. So I'm doing that with this lowercase d valet signal, which corresponds to this register bank here. And here I'm taking a little advantage of the fact that in HCL, remember, order doesn't matter, so I can declare the registers afterwards. You don't have to do this, it's whatever you feel is a more logical order, but here I just said, I would declare the registers in between my fetch and decode, registers between fetch and decode, in between my fetch code and my decode code. But you could do that in some other way. Okay. And obviously I'm omitting, I haven't shown the code for using source B or val B, but, and also I haven't shown the code for like setting the PC, but we obviously have all that in here. But the general pattern we follow is this sort of, we're gonna have our stages set values for the next stage with the lowercase signals, read values from the previous stage with the uppercase signals. And we can kind of look at each stage independently and say, if I'm writing the code for this stage, I'm just processing my input signals that start with the look, uppercase letter into my output signals, which start with the lowercase letter. So questions on the code here? And so we have this transformation from our unpipeline to our pipeline code, where the big thing is that we were passing values directly between the stages on a single line, in this case, like through RA. Instead, I'm passing that through a pipeline register, which means that I'm using the input to the pipeline register in one stage and the output of the pipeline register in another. And as far as what are the pipeline registers, so I could figure out what goes in them in this case by looking just at my diagram and saying, okay, what are all the things that are going from fetch to decode? Let's write them down. Same thing from decode to execute and so on. So questions about our HCL code for doing add queue with a pipeline? Okay, so let's consider the problem of doing this on the full processor. So we have our single cycle processor, and we know what our stages that our textbook would like us to use are. So these are what we're going to turn into our pipeline stages. But first, we're going to have to do something we did earlier with the add processor. And that's right now, we have some stage signals that go from one stage to a stage that's not next. And we want to have it be the case that values go from one stage to the next stage to the next stage, never skipping around, because if they skip around, we'll have a mix of values from two different instructions in a stage. We don't want our write-back stage to have some values from the memory stage and some values from the execute stage together. That's not going to work. We need to have consistency. And we have two cases where we violate that consistency here. So one is the same case we saw in the add processor, which is that our destination register indices are coming from fetch, which means that that's a different instruction than our values are coming from, which is from executor memory. The other issue we have is that some of our values to write back are coming from memory, and some are coming from execute, and we want them to probably all come from memory because that's the stage before execute, so before write back. So we want to fix this. So here's my fix for that. That I've carefully redrawn my register to write signals to go through decode, execute, memory, and all the way to write back. I also have made a choice to relocate the muxes that previously were in the write back stage here into the execute stage. So I'm just making that decision earlier than I would otherwise. I didn't have to do that. It would still work if I had that mux in the write back stage. It will turn out when we talk about doing some things to deal with problems with pipelining later, that it'll be really handy to do this computation of what the destination register index is earlier, which is why I moved the mux in that way. But indeed, it would also work if I had this mux in the write-back stage, or even if I put those muxes in memory or execute, like it would still be functional. And I've also redrawn the signal that previously went directly from the ALU output to the register file to go through our memory stage. We're going to pass the value through the memory stage and then to the write-back stage. So now that I've done this, all my values go from fetch to decode to execute to memory to write-back, with, if you're paying close attention, the exception of the return address, but we'll deal with that later. So we don't have that problem of mixing values from two different instructions. And so once I've done that, I can add pipeline registers between my instructions. To keep things simple, I've just drawn a big register for all the values, but in writing HCL, we declare a register bank with separate fields for each of the signals. Questions? This idea for pipelining our whole processor? So we have sort of our general strategy, and one way you could do this is you could say, okay, now that I know how it's divided up into stages, I'm going to write the code for each stage. And just when you're writing the code for each stage, remember, you're taking the outputs of the prior stage. So if it's decode, they will start with capital D, for example, and producing the inputs for the next stage, start with a lowercase d, and also dealing with the things that happen in that stage. But as far as passing values, you're always using the pipeline registers which correspond to the letter of your stage. Now, there's going to be some exceptions to this, but these are exceptions where we deliberately, for some reason, want to do something with a different instruction, but where we're in the execute stage, but we want to do something with the current instruction that's in a different stage. If we want to do that, then yes, you might use a signal that, you know, doesn't start with E in our execute stage from another stage. But if you're using, you know, a D signal in the execute stage, you should think, huh, I'm using something from a different instruction. Does that really make sense? So all our values are together. And generally, the way our instructions are going to communicate is like through the register file in memory, which we're going to use in the appropriate stage, or through like control flow when we talk about implementing like conjunct and so on. But otherwise, we should not be mixing values from instructions, which means we'll follow this convention of we're reading the prior stage's outputs and writing the next stage's inputs. And that's the work we're doing at each stage. Now, there's one issue with this, which has to do with control signals. And if you remember, when I talked about the data path versus the control path, I told you we stopped drawing the control path in this diagram. But it's still there, and we need to think of what happens to it with pipelining. So I'm going to give a simple example of part of our control path, which is the signals that control the read-enable and write-enable on the data map. And the way that you probably think of that working is we take the I code, like is this an RMove queue or an add, for example, and usually decide do we read memory or not, do we write memory or not. And if we just use this logic as is in our pipeline processor, we have a problem. And the problem is that this I code here, this is from fetch, and this is from memory. This is in memory here that uses the data memory. And if we think of what's happening in our processor, if our program is like mrmoveq and add xor and, well, if our and instruction is being fetched, then our xor instruction is being decoded, and our add instruction is being written back, executed, and our mrmoveq is in the memory stage. But this signal here, determining whether we read memory or not, is coming from the AND. It's not coming from the mrmoveq. That's going to be a problem. We don't want to use the instruction we're fetching now to decide whether we read memory now, because the thing we're reading memory for is something we fetched 3 cycles ago. So we want to know not what is the current instruction I code, we want to know what was the instruction I code 3 cycles ago. How do we find that out? Well, we better have remembered it a while ago. And so we better have gotten it from passed through the pipeline. So hopefully it's going to come from a pipeline register. And that pipeline register will come from, in this case, the execute stage. Now, the execute stage doesn't have the instruction memory either, so it can't have gotten this value directly from the instruction memory, so it will have gotten it from the decode stage, which also doesn't have the instruction memory, and that will have gotten it from the actual fetch stage. So to pass the information to this read-enable logic, we need to pass it all the way from the fetch stage through pipeline registers. So we make sure we have it from the right time. We want the value that we fetched several cycles ago, so we're going to pass it through registers each of those cycles as it goes through the pipeline in order to have the same value from that we fetched, you know, the same coming from the same place that this address and this data input are coming from, which presumably are also from pipeline registers. So questions about why we need to pass the I code through these pipeline registers? So question, why was it a problem before we added the pipeline registers? What would go wrong? So in our example here, where our program is mremove q, then add, then XOR, then AND, by the time mremove q gets to the memory stage, we're not dealing with mremove q in the fetch stage anymore. We're dealing with the AND. And the AND is going to be what our I code coming out of the instruction memory is. But we will have the values for the mremove q going into this address and data input because they'll come from the pipeline registers we see right here. And our solution is that this pipeline register right here should also include the I code. So we can get it from the same place. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so showing this sort of an HCL code, initially we started with code from our single cycle processor where we just got the I code from the instruction memory and we're using it to decide, oh, sometimes I read, sometimes I don't. And what we're going to end up with is we're going to have the I code passed through pipeline registers. So I'm going to have it as a field in probably each of my pipeline registers. And I'm going to use the I code value to actually make my decision. I code value from the memory stage, not one from one of the other stages. And to make that happen, it's going to be need to be passed through each of my pipeline registers. Questions on this logic for using? Okay. So now we know about sort of implementing this straightforward pipeline processor, but something that was alluded to earlier is that this processor doesn't quite always work. There's one case people were worried about when we talked about our add example, which was what if we have similar registers used by a consecutive instruction? So let's look at one of those examples. So you're at add R8 R9, and then add R9 R8. And initially, R8 is 800 and R9 is 900. So what should happen here is that this first instruction should set R9 to 1700, which is that is 800 plus 900. And the second instruction should set R8 to 1700, the value of R9, plus the value of R8, which is 800, or to 2500. So that's what we expect to happen. That's what would happen in our single cycle processor. In this pipeline design here, that's not what happens. And the reason why is that, during cycle two here, we're computing 800 plus 900. That's the same time at which we're reading register 9. And register 9 still is 900. We haven't written it back yet because that's not going to happen until the end of cycle 3 here. So we read 900. So we're reading a value that should be 1700, but it's 900. So this type of problem is known as a hazard, this type of problem in general. So a hazard is what we'll call any case where our straightforward pipeline implementation doesn't work or we can't figure out how to execute an instruction on it. So in this case, it doesn't work. We have a way of executing the instruction, but sometimes we get the wrong value. And this particular kind of hazard we'll call a data hazard because the problem is because we have the wrong data. The data we have is an old version of a value instead of the current version when we do the straightforward thing. And a way of looking at what happened is that our instruction set specification says the way add instructions work are they read the register values, add them together, and store the result. So our ISA specification says that to run these two instructions, you should read R8 and R9, then write R9, then we should read R9 and R8, and then write R8. But that's not what we implemented. Instead, what we implemented is that we read R8 and R9, and we read R9 and R8, then we write R9 and write R8, and the difference is notable because we're reading an out-of-date value. So we can notice what's happening here. So we're not following the instruction set specification in our pipeline processor. So we're going to want to fix this. And we're going to talk about several different solutions for this problem. I'm going to start with the solution that for us as a hardware designer is going to be the simplest solution. And that solution is going to be, well, I told you that the problem here is that the instruction set says this is not how add instructions work. So one solution is we can say, well, the instruction set's wrong. Instruction set specification's wrong. It says that add instructions immediately take effect in time for the next instruction. That's not actually how they work. Let's rewrite that to say add instructions take effect in time for three instructions later. And if you're writing assembly, you're writing a compiler, now you need to read our specification, and it says the add instruction writes to that register three instructions later, but you can't, if you use it before then, you'll get the wrong value. And therefore, if you're writing a compiler, like to do this, you need to implement nops. If you're writing assembly by hand, you need to do that. And this is a solution to the problem. We've solved the problem now. Now our processor follows our ISA specification, and you know, we just fixed the ISA specification to make that happen. Didn't actually change any of the hardware. So most of you are probably pretty unsatisfied with this solution. One problem is that this makes writing assembly by hand really annoying. You have to track each instruction you have before, make sure you're not using a value too soon. It seems really error prone. It's also a little something compilers can deal with, but it's annoying for compilers in particular. Like, you know, if your compiler gets this wrong, your program has the wrong output. And perhaps a more fundamental issue is that this design says that, you know, our instruction set is now built for a particular processor design. And if we want to use the same instruction set with a new processor design where we have different pipeline stages, the natural thing that this would say to do is that we need to change the instruction set. We need to recompile all our code or rewrite all our assembly code we wrote by hand. And usually that's not considered an acceptable solution, mainly for that reason. So the combination of, you know, do we really want to recompile when we make a new processor design that has different numbers of knobs we need in different places? And also, yeah, that the complication of that, you know, implementing this in compilers might not be super simple. So you probably assume that no one does this. And well, there's very few platforms that have done this, but there have actually been historical architectures which have followed this approach. Now they don't do it for this add hazard, because it turns out we're gonna have a much more efficient solution for this add problem. But there's other hazards which real platforms have said, this is my solution to that hazard, that I'm just gonna make the ISA say, this instruction takes effect a little later. Probably the biggest example of that is that some platforms have had what are called branch delay slots. So they have their jump instructions take effect not after the next instruction, but an instruction later. Just because their hardware didn't implement making the jump instruction happen right away, so they just made it happen later. This approach has mostly fallen out of favor because it turns out that this idea of dealing with the processor design changing makes that pretty awkward. So now we have these instruction sets that are still in use with these branch delay slots, where the modern implementations of those instruction sets don't actually need those delay slots. They don't actually need that solution, but it's still part of the instruction set, so they still need to implement it, even though the hardware design doesn't like take advantage of it anymore. And avoiding that sort of awkwardness has made this approach really fall out of favor. But this does suggest a more practical, more common approach we can use, which is that we can say, well, the compiler could solve this by inserting nops. So maybe instead of the compiler doing that, since we don't like to have to recompile things all the time for different processors, maybe the hardware could do that. The hardware could somehow detect that there's a problem here, and rather than letting the problem happen, it can just insert nops that the compiler should have. And this idea is called stalling. We'll delay the second instruction until it's ready to run. So this is a less simple solution for our hardware people because we need to now add some extra logic. But it's not actually that much extra logic. So we need some sort of circuit that will leave the program counter the same, and some sort of circuit that will put do nothing values in the registers rather than trying to run an instruction that's not ready yet. So what that would look might look like, one example here is that we'll take add R8 or 9, is that we'll fetch the first add R8 or 9, we'll run it, and then we'll detect somehow that, oh, I can't actually do the add R9 or 8, and we'll just keep this add R9 or 8 in the fetch stage and send some do nothing values. In this case, I send F, which presumably tells our register file not to run anything. And we do that until we're ready to actually read the register. And it turns out that it's written at the end of cycle 3. So at that point, we actually send the values to the decode stage because now we can read the 1700 from the register and not the old value. And so what we've paid for in doing this is that because we had this hazard, to resolve the hazard, we spent 2 cycles basically doing nothing. So if we have to do this all the time, it's probably not very efficient. But if we only have to do it occasionally, we solve the problem, and we still have most of the advantages of pipelining. So questions? Yes?
How are we going to determine whether, I'm assuming if we have 2 add instructions that reference completely different registers, then would we want to have a case where it doesn't actually
Question, do we want to have a case where it doesn't stall? Yes. So to determine whether or not we stall, we're going to have some logic which looks at the register indices involved and figures out, yes, there's a problem or no, there isn't a problem. We'll eventually be implementing that for a case with stalling, but first we'll look at some other hazard handling. But the general pattern we'll see for data hazards with data, is that most of our work is going to be looking at register indices and seeing, do these use the same registers or not? Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So this is one way of visualizing what happens in the stall. Another way, which might perhaps be clearer, is I can sort of say what instructions in what stage during each cycle. So we have our first add, which goes through the pipeline normally from fetch to decode to execute to write back. And what we're doing with stalling is, in this example, we're keeping the next instruction in the fetch stage until it's ready to go to the decode stage. And while we're doing that, the decode stage has to do something. So we're going to put a nop in there, and a term we'll use for that nop is a pipeline bubble. So it's kind of like air in our pipeline, but we have to actually put something explicitly there, so we're going to put the work of a nop in the decode stage so we don't have the decode stage do something we don't want it to do, and more importantly, the decode stage cause the write-back stage to eventually do something we don't want it to do. So this nop is going just through our pipeline like a normal instruction, even though we didn't actually fetch it. So questions on sort of how this diagram works? Okay, and I guess something to note is that I'm sort of showing this as we figure out we want to stall when we fetch an instruction. Sometimes that might not be practical. Sometimes we might not be able to figure out there's a problem until later, and that's fine. So instead of this design, we could have had this add R8 or 9 go to the decode stage, and we could keep it there, and we could have the next add instruction be stuck in fetch behind it. The important thing is that when we have any sort of stalling, even if we're stalling an instruction into code, that means the instructions behind it in fetch don't get to move. So they both stay in place. And this might something we might do if we like get to the code stage and then we figure out, oh, I can't keep going. And we could do that in this case. We could say, let's try to decode it. Oh, that register I'm reading doesn't work. So we could do that detection in the logic in the decode stage instead of the fetch stage. And it's the same result. We're still wasting two cycles because ultimately we still have two cycles during which we're not fetching new instructions. We're just keeping the same instructions where they are at the beginning of our pipeline. So questions on sort of this idea of what stalling is? Okay. So some vocabulary now. So when I talk about data hazards, it looks like, data hazard, some people might say, oh, it's when one instruction uses a value another needs. That is not a data hazard. So when one instruction uses a value that another produces, so they have a dependency. One instruction depends on the other. So we'll call that a dependency. So in the case of our adds here, one of our adds produced a value the other needed to read. So those are dependencies. But not all dependencies are hazards. Sometimes they're fine. So for example, when I added the nops, there was no hazard anymore. But in my naive pipeline design, it would just work. A hazard is when it won't work in our pipeline before we do some extra work. So just because there's a dependency doesn't mean we have a hazard. And also, to tell if we have a hazard, we need to know what kind of pipeline are we dealing with. It's going to matter what our stages are. So if we only have a single cycle processor, we don't have any hazards, but we still have dependencies. And whether we have hazards or not in a pipeline design is going to depend on exactly what the stages are and how many there are and so on. So that's just a vocabulary note, because the confusion I want to avoid is don't think just because two instructions depend on each other that always means there's a hazard. Sometimes means there's a hazard. It's a condition for a data hazard, not a requirement. Okay, so let's look at an example with maybe some data hazards. So here I have some code that does a bunch of adds, and I want to say, let's resolve data hazards with stalling. How many stalls are needed? And let's say, by this I mean, how many cycles without fetching new instructions? Just to be explicit. And as you can see from what I have on the slide, my hint for how I would recommend answering this is fill out this table of during each cycle, what instructions in what stage, fetch, decode, execute, write back. And try to figure out when we need to delay things. And for figuring out when we need to delay things, well, I told you that when we have a hazard, it's because there's a dependency. So let's look at what the dependencies are. So this first instruction writes R9, which is read by the third instruction. So that's a dependency. Maybe it causes a hazard, maybe it doesn't. But it's a dependency, we have to watch out for that. The second instruction writes R11, which is read by the fourth instruction. So that's another dependency which could cause a hazard. So those are the places where we need to watch out for hazards. And the pattern of what we're going to look for is remember that the value is written at the end of the write-back stage. So if we have write-back right there, ending at after cycle 3, only after where I put that dot can we actually read the value of R9. I need to make sure the read of R9 that I draw out happens after that dot. Who likes some more time? Okay. So who thinks we want, say, no cycles, that there's actually no hazards? Okay. How about one cycle? Okay. How about two cycles? How about three cycles? Four more cycles? Okay, so our plurality answer is two cycles. Let me go through how I would approach this. So we found our dependencies, and we know that for this first instruction, this value of r9write needs to be read by the third instruction. So we'll keep that in mind, and we'll go through filling out this chart. So the next instruction, I fetch it right after the first one. I'd like to decode it right after I'm executing that one. I'd like to execute it right back. And since we have no dependencies, we should be able to do that. And we also know that there's going to be a dependency later on with the last instruction. We'll have to worry about later. So I have my second row filled out. So now I need to get to this next row. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to fetch this instruction, then decode it. But I have a problem. I can't do that because the value I want to read hasn't been written yet. It hasn't been written until this dot. We're not at that dot. So this decode here is not going to work. We're going to have to delay the decode until later. And then we shouldn't have any problems. So then I consider my next instruction. So if we're just repeating the decode here, I could fetch it, but I can't go beyond fetch until the prior instruction 3 goes beyond decode. You know, I'm stuck behind it. And then after that, there's a question of, I can decode as far as, like, I can put an instruction in decode. And my question is, if I decode then, will I read the right value? And to figure that out, well, I say, well, the value we might have a problem with is R11. R11 has been written at the end of cycle 4. We're reading in cycle 5. There's actually no problem. And what happened is that because we were delayed by a cycle by the prior instruction, because we can't go ahead of it, we have to decode after it decodes, we have to stay in order in our pipeline, that was enough to delay us to handle this dependency too. So this ends up just working. Oh, and I wrote MW. Okay, that's, yeah. WEW. And so I end up, there's one cycle where I can't fetch a new instruction, you know, where as I've drawn it here, you know, I'm just fetching the same thing twice. That's one cycle of stalling. So I just get one and not two. And I think probably the way most people get two is you think, oh, I have two separate dependencies. Each of them need a cycle. But it turns out that that cycle is kind of the same cycle they need. So you just need to handle it once. And I always recommend, I always try to go through problems like this by writing out diagrams like this to see issues like that. Some questions? So this, yes. Why are there two fetches? So what I've chosen to do here is I said, oh, we get this R8, R9 to decode, and we tried to do the decode and realize we can't, so we'll just repeat it again the next cycle. And if we're doing that, then we're gonna try to fetch R11, R10 and find out, oh, we can't actually fetch this to decode and we'll fetch it again the next cycle. So this is one way I could implement the stalling idea. Another way I could implement this is I could instead somehow detect during fetch that I can't move on to the code for the third instruction and end up with a timeline like it fetches twice, this is our stall, and then we go, only then do we go on to the code, execute right back, and we have nothing for the fourth instruction during that cycle. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And I've drawn out my sort of rigid solution, which follows that other convention where I like tried to fetch and figured out I couldn't actually advance. So I drew my cycle slowing that way rather than doubling the decode, but they're both equivalent. So questions? Yes, yes. The question, will the dependencies always be between the code and writeback? Dependencies in register values will, because the code and writeback are the places where we use the register value. So if we had dependencies on like values in memory, then those would be different stages, for example. Does that answer your question? Yes. For R9 in the third line, we fetch it as soon as it's finished writing.
Yeah.
So what matters for these the dependencies in terms of the lines I'm drawing here are that I'm drawing the line from write back to decode, because write back is where we write it, but at the end of the cycle, and decode is where we read it, but kind of near the beginning of the cycle. Does that answer your question? So that's right now where how our values are being passed. We'll have a technique that we'll talk about next where we're going to somehow pass values without waiting for the writeback stage, which will be our next topic. Got questions on our stalling first? Okay, so stalling is nice. The nicest thing about stalling is that if we have a hazard, we can probably resolve it with stalling. It's kind of a generic solution. The not nice thing about it is that we're waiting like two extra cycles with our simple pipeline. It's going to be three with our five-stage pipeline for pretty much any dependency on two directly adjacent instructions. And it turns out that if we look at what's actually happening when we run these instructions, there's a convincing argument that we shouldn't need to do that. So let's look back at our hazard case, that we had our value here, the value for R9, which was supposed to be 1700, the value that was written by the previous instruction, but that value hasn't been written yet. But if we look at our pipeline registers, we've in fact computed that value at the same time. We have the value already. The problem is that it's not in the place where we put the value we read from the register. So if we're looking at our diagram, while I have the value sitting on the input to this register here, that's wrong, the 900 value, I have the right value sitting over here, because we just added it together. Or alternately, if I think of the next cycle, like soon, I'm going to have a value sitting on the output of that register that is the correct value, but the adder is going to have the output of its register, which is the wrong value. And what our fix to this is that, well, we have the values in our circuit, they're just in the wrong places, so we're going to want to just move the value around. So we're going to talk about solving this problem without stalling by saying, okay, so let's just take this value here and send it up here. That's going to be our solution. This is going to be called forwarding. We're sending the value from elsewhere in the pipeline to where it's needed. So there are questions about this sort of high-level idea, that why we have the value, why the value is already computed. So we computed the value, we just haven't written it yet, and normally we have to wait quite a while for it to be written, and then we have to wait an additional time to read it. But we can take a shortcut and just say, let's just take the value we're about to write and shove it right where we want it, up in that pipeline. So let's add this to our circuit. So we have our wrong R9 value over here, and we have our correct one over here. So we want to add that wire there. But the problem is that now we have two inputs going into the same register. We can't do that. We have to have one. And we don't always want to send this value. Sometimes there won't be a dependency. So we're going to use a mux. We're going to have a mux that selects between the two values. So sometimes we're going to take that value there, sometimes we're not. And so we solve this data hazard problem. Now, if you're thinking about data hazards in general, like this idea that we have two instructions depend on each other, you might say, wait a moment, this is only one way two instructions can depend on each other. So for example, instead of adding our 9 to our 8, couldn't we do it the other way around? Couldn't we have our 9 be the other side of the add? And yeah, we could. R9 could be RB. And we can handle that in the same way, but that needs a different mux with a different connection. And we'll just do that. And if you're thinking further ahead, you might say, oh, couldn't we have an instruction, a case where we want to get a value that we're about to write over to here and or over to RB's value. And yes, so we're going to have a whole bunch of extra cases. Just going to make this maybe a little complicated, but we're saving a whole bunch of cycles. So it's going to be worth it. We're going to avoid doing stalling. Okay, so questions on this idea of forwarding and sort of why we're adding these muxes. So a way that might be more intuitive to think about it is we're reading the wrong value and we're saying, oh, we're just replacing it with the right value just before we need it. So that's what this design is that we say, here's the wrong value and just before we need it, we're just gonna substitute the right value as if that bad read never happened. And obviously this is only gonna work if we have the right value somewhere later in the circuit and we figured out where it is, but we're gonna have to do that. And what we'll talk about next time is, well, if you have this design, you know, you say, okay, you know, sometimes we want to take this value from down here and have it replace the value we just read from the register file. But we need to write code to do that. How are we gonna figure out when we want to do that versus when we don't? This isn't like the muxes we've typically done before, where generally we're just looking at, like, is it an add or is it an add or remove queue? Like, obviously we don't want to do that for every single add, because not all the adds are gonna have that value coming from the previous instruction. So what we're gonna do instead is we're gonna somehow look at the register indices of the two instructions we're running and figure out when we want to do this forwarding based on that. And this is why, way back, I said it would end up being really convenient to compute the destination register indices in the code. And we'll talk about what exactly that logic looks like next time. Yes, I have.